So good evening. What a great audience. So welcome to the final lecture in the Melbourne Neuroscience Institute public seminar series. I would firstly like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land in which this event is taking place, the land of the Wurundjeri, and pay respect to their elders and families. My name is Trevor Kilpatrick. I'm director of the Melbourne Neuroscience Institute at the University of Melbourne. The Melbourne Neuroscience Institute, or MNI as we like to call it, is the principal body for the promotion of cross-disciplinary research in the neurosciences at the University of Melbourne. The MNI supports, engages, and facilitates high-quality projects with an emphasis on value-adding through coordination of effort and collaboration, and aims to showcase the university's prowess in fundamental, translational, and clinical research in the neurosciences and related disciplines. We are very pleased to be hosting Baroness Suzanne Greenfeld, CBA, here at the University of Melbourne. Susan is a British neuroscientist, writer, broadcaster, and a member of the House of Lords. Specialising in the physiology of the brain, Susan researches the impact of 21st century technologies on the mind, how the brain generates consciousness, and interrogates novel approaches to neurodegenerative diseases, such as Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease. Susan Greenfeld was an undergraduate at St Hilda's College, Oxford. She took a DPhil at the University Department of Pharmacology at Oxford and subsequently held research fellowships in the Department of Physiology, Oxford, the College de France, Paris, and NYU. In 1985, she was appointed university lecturer in synaptic pharmacology and fellow and tutor in medicine, Linkage College, Oxford, becoming a full professor in 1996. Has since been awarded 30 honorary degrees from a number of British and foreign universities. In 1998, she was appointed Director of the Royal Institution of Great Britain, and she's currently Director of the Institute for the Future of the Mind at the James Martin 21st Century School, as well as a Senior Research Fellow at Lincoln College and Honorary Fellow at St Hilda's College, all at Oxford University. Susan Greenfeld holds a multidisciplinary research, heads a multidisciplinary research group exploring novel brain mechanisms linked to neurodegeneration. She also studies the physical basis of the mind. In 1995, she published her own theory of consciousness, Journey to the Centres of the Mind, which is further developed in the publication, The Private Life of the Brain, in 2000. In addition, she has developed an interest in the young mind, and the impact of 21st century technologies on how young minds think and feel. Having said all this, it is a great pleasure to invite Baroness Professor Greenfeld to deliver her lecture, The Neuroscience of Consciousness. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Trevor. It's a huge pleasure to be here. And I'm told that you at the back can hear me, is that true? Hands up if you can hear me. Oh, it's, that's audience participation straight away. It's wonderful to be here, and I'm very honoured to have spent a very exciting day at this fabulous new building. I'm really jealous. I think all my colleagues in Oxford will be jealous at the facilities that you have here, and just the way it seems to help you think. You know, the sort of environment that I imagine if one worked here would really aid and abet constructive, creative thinking and conversations and so on. So, for all of you who had a part in that, and I know Trevor has won, many, many congratulations. I think it's a fantastic facility. So the one thing, though, that Trevor didn't mention, which I'm really proud of, was that in 2006, among all these other garlands and blue ribbons and so on, I was awarded Honorary Australian of the Year. This doesn't help me through customs or visa. But I do have the plaque, like the T-shirt, I have the plaque, Honorary Australian of the Year, for someone who shows Australian values. I'm not sure what they are. perhaps someone can enlighten me at some stage. I do feel that Australia really is my second home, especially in the summer months, although I have to say this morning did remind me very much of Oxford this morning. Anyway, you're not here to talk about the weather. We're here to really talk about something that I think is a fascinating question that not just scientists, not just neuroscientists, but anyone surely must think about. And it's, I would argue, one of the biggest questions any human being can ask, which is, what are you experiencing right now? And however close you are to the person sitting next to you, however articulate, however musical, however poetic, no one can share what you're experiencing now firsthand. It's this wonderful subjectivity that is absolutely unique to you that makes things so special, makes life worth living. If someone says you're never going to be conscious ever again, wouldn't that be tantamount to dying, effectively? So this inner experience that no one else can share poses, I think, as the biggest issue facing us, the biggest question, the biggest fascination. What is it? How can we understand it? How does it come about? Well, let me just say straight away, I'm not going to be answering any of those questions. What I am going to try and show you is how neuroscience can bring to the party, I think, a valid contribution. It's not going to be the answers, but I hope that along with the philosophers and all other of the great thinkers who for centuries have considered this issue, that we do have a contribution that we can make, which means that, of course, if we're talking about neuroscience, if we're seeing this through the prism of the neuroscientist, inevitably we start with this rather unpromising-looking object on the screen. Now, I love this picture because it does remind me a long time ago when I was a student in Oxford and we had to dissect a human brain. Professor Fink here was in that very department of human anatomy at Oxford where they wheel on these trolleys containing sort of Tupperware buckets with human brains inside them. And have people dissected? Hands up. Who's dissected a brain? Oh, wow, God, I'm talking to the converted. Everyone's demon neuroscientist. Well, for those of you who didn't put your hand up, please listen to the story. And those of you who did, bear with me, because I think it is worth a thought. That there you are with the brain in formalin, fixative, to enable you to dissect it. So you're wearing surgical gloves. And I remember, perhaps those of you who put your hands up had this very same experience. Actually, I'll ask for a show of hands in a minute if you did. You put your hand in this bucket, and then you hold, just like in the picture, you hold a human brain in one hand. And I remember thinking, if I wasn't wearing surgical gloves and a bit, for some reason, dislodged under my fingernail, would that be the bit that somebody loved with? Would it be a habit? Would it be a memory? Would it be a habit like, let's say, biting your fingernail? Can you have the habit of biting your fingernails underneath your fingernails? Okay, hands up, the people with their hands up, hands up, who also have had those thoughts. You must have. Yes, there we are, well done. Yeah. So this brings home to you the fascination of neuroscience and how it can almost drive you mad, actually. And perhaps someone would say that is a prerequisite for neuroscience, that you have to be slightly mad. Is that how can something that gets under your fingernail give you the experience you're having now? I mean, it's such a sort of leap to make through something that's just really kind of mushy and boring to something that makes your whole life worthwhile. So how do we get there? What is it, if we're talking about the neuroscience, what is it that translates into something that is you, something that is so subjective and personal? This isn't you. This is George Bernard Shaw. And the reason I like this picture is because you can just, philosophers hate this, if I say, you can just tell he's thinking. You can just tell he's thinking. Yeah, what's going on behind those piercing eyes? What's going on behind your piercing eyes, even if they're not piercing? What's going on that gives you this subjective take on the world, this phenomenology that we call consciousness? So that's what we're going to look at. We're going to see how neuroscience can help us make some kind of progress. And perhaps I should say from the outset, what we are not going to be able to do is work out how the water is turned into wine. How does the water of boring old brain cells and sludgy stuff translate into the wine of phenomenological subjective experience? So let's start, nonetheless, with some assumptions. The first might seem pretty obvious, and that is, sadly, that consciousness can't be formally defined. Now, this really does exercise many people, and indeed, for some, they actually shrug and give up. Can you imagine? We wouldn't have any more lecture if we gave up now, because we can't formally define it. I think the problem is that normally our strategies for defining things fall down here. There's two broad strategies that normally we'd use to define something. One is referral to a higher set. For example, I'd say, oh, a table is a piece of furniture. Love is an emotion. Consciousness is a what? What is it? There's no higher set of which consciousness is a subpart. The other is operational definitions. Flight is when you defy gravity. Consciousness is when you do what? You're not doing anything, apart from laughing at my rather poor jokes. And yeah, I hope you're still conscious at this early stage of the talk. So therefore, our normal strategies, either operational or referral to a higher set, don't work. And that's why I think we flounder in trying to define what it means. Now, if you're a neuroscientist, if you're a scientist, happily, these nuances don't worry us, because what I'd like to suggest is a working definition of consciousness. And I don't know if there's any philosophers in the audience. There often are, and they never put their hands up if there's any philosophers. Until the end. Oh, there's one. Until the end, when they ask some highly technical and erudite question, you know, and they've been sort of keeping themselves in disguise. But I know that I'll address you as the token philosopher, but I'm sorry if this offends you, but I'll just give an informal definition that it's just what I described. It's the first-person subjective world as it seems to you. Let's be even more crude. It's what you're going to lose tonight, in all probability. And even worse, we all know what consciousness is, don't we? So why don't we just press on and see what progress we can make? So any of those levels, I'm afraid, aren't very academic, but if we're to make any progress, unless we're all going to go and have the drink right now, I'm afraid we have to live with this rather inadequate forms of definition. This problem of the water into wine, the translation of the squalor of everyday brain cells into the subjectivity of your wonderful experience, has been called by someone called David Chalmers, an Australian, the hard problem. Pretty straightforward. And I'd like to suggest that this hard problem is very simply that. What's the difference between sleeping and wakefulness? Now, some people have other concepts of consciousness that I think can actually confuse us, but I'd just like to clear them out the way right now. Some people talk about self-consciousness, and I'd like to suggest to you that that is an add-on luxury on normal consciousness. It's something that after the age of 1.5, 2 years of age, human beings are capable of having, but I don't think a rat ever looks itself in the mirror and says, I'm a rat. You know, they're not self-conscious, but they could be conscious. So I wouldn't like to trouble us with this notion of what philosophers call meta-representation, that is to say, this notion of self-consciousness. The other issue is subconscious. Any devotees of Freud, of course, will be very familiar with that, where you are conscious, but you're not conscious of a particular thing, even though it may inform that current state. So I don't want to really focus, we can in the Q&A, on the subconscious or self-conscious. I simply suggest the hard problem is going to be enough for anyone for an hour. That is to say, the difference between unconsciousness and common or garden raw consciousness. I'd also like to assume it's generated by, for, and of the brain, because that's an area that I'm familiar with. You might think this is pretty obvious, but I just put it as an assumption because it is. Some people, so-called panpsychics, as far as I understand it, posit that perhaps consciousness is an irreducible property of the universe. It's there somehow out in the ether. And your brain is like some kind of satellite dish that sort of picks it up somehow. Now, one can't prove or disprove that. And therefore, it's not very useful if we're trying to make a journey now, if we're trying to make some progress, especially in relation to the brain. So I'd like to pay my respects to that theory and place it to one side as something that's not going to be in our sights, in our crosshairs this evening. And finally, any scientific explanation must include this quintessential feature of subjectivity. Now, why have I put scientific in inverted commas like that? It's because it's a word that's often used. And it's because in science, you are ruthlessly objective, as I'm sure, given the number of hands that went up, there's many scientists in the room, we all know the whole essence of science is objectivity. It's impartiality. You are an observer, and you observe what someone else observes, and it's reported even in the passive. So you would never say, I made up a solution, because that sounds fishy. You'll say, rather tortuously, a solution was made up. Oh, yeah, because just, you know, it just absolutely preserves the fact that your solution is the same as someone else's solution. The agent is trivial relative to the action. However, where does that land us if we're thinking about consciousness, given it's quintessentially subjective? And this is why I think so many scientists are very leery of studying consciousness, why you can't apply for grants to study consciousness. You have to disguise it as schizophrenia or anesthesia or something like this. And some wag has actually said that any scientist trying to embark on the neuroscience of consciousness is a CLM. I bet you can't guess what a CLM is. It's a career-limiting move. Okay, so these are the assumptions that I place before you. And so long as you buy into this, along with my promise that I won't be able to turn the water into wine, stick with me, because now we can go on our journey. And this is where we start. So where do we start? So there you are, you're going to adopt a neuroscience approach. We've defined something as quintessentially subjective that's going to be related to the brain, and here is a brain in situ. Just look at it again. It occupies the same universe as tooth enamel or earwax or nasal hair, and yet it does so much more. So how does it do that? How does it do those things? It is pretty banal looking at it like that. So perhaps, and again, those of you who aren't neuroscientists, perhaps you're also familiar with the very obvious feature that the brain is characterized by these anatomically macro-scale brain regions, like this cauliflower-looking thing on the back. Where is it? Actually, I can't. Where is it? Where's the pointer? I'm frightened I'll get... Oh, there we are. So, yeah, where we are. So this thing on the back, an outer layer, and the spinal cord, and so on. So that begs the question, and many people, when confronted with the brain and asked to study consciousness, will immediately say, well, is there a center for consciousness? Is there a brain area that generates consciousness? Very straightforward idea. So let's try and look at that one first. Could one of these areas be the center for consciousness? So that's what I think. There's no such thing as a center for consciousness. Why do I say that? For two reasons. First, it actually doesn't make much logical sense. Just think of a brain within a brain being a center. What is a center anyway, just out of interest? What happens inside a center? Doesn't really help us saying something's a center for something. And anyone, I don't know if there's any people who lived in England in the 50s and 60s, when I was young and read a comic called The Beezer, and they featured these characters called the Numbskulls. And the Numbskulls lived inside this little man's head and got him up to no end of mischief. And it's actually my first lesson in determinism, actually. Anyway, you have the crisp-eating department, and then you have the eye department, the nose-cleaning department. Notice the doors are rigidly shut, the compartments are solid. Top left is the consciousness center, clearly, the chief numbskull in his room. So I, with all humility, suggest this might be a metaphor for people that say there's centers for this and that, right? Now, if that was the case, we ask ourselves, as I said, what goes on inside the center? So what goes on inside the numbskull's brain? Are there mini numbskulls? And inside the mini numbskulls, are there micro numbskulls? And then are there nano numbskulls and pico numbskulls? So you end up miniaturizing the issue, but has that actually really explained anything? It's what Ramachandran calls an anesthetic explanation. That's to say, something that sounds good, but actually, when you think about it, doesn't really help you. So, if we're looking at a center for consciousness, I'd like to suggest to you that actually it doesn't really make sense. And anyway, we know the brain doesn't work like that. The neuroscientists say, well, no, there's, for vision, for example, at least 30 different brain areas related to vision that divvies up the job into color, form, and motion. And we know that any one brain area will participate in many functions, and when I say any one function is divvied up. So it's not as if you have a one-on-one of brain function and brain area tying up together. And moreover, we can look at empirical evidence also suggesting that there is no such thing as a single center for consciousness. In this experiment, what they did was to administer anesthesia, thereby abolishing consciousness, and you would think if there was a single center for that facility, as the anesthesia was given, one area and one area alone would suddenly shut down. And I hope you can see here that that's not the case. So this is with bupivacaine and anesthetic and with MRI scanning. I'm sure people, especially here, are very familiar with this. And if you're not, all you have to focus on are the bright bits, the yellow, red bits. And as you can appreciate, everything uniformly shuts down as the anesthetic dose is increased. So looking for a center for consciousness isn't a very helpful start, I would suggest, for a neuroscience explanation, because there's no such thing. Second, what are we going to do? You see, I think we need to work out what the problems are first and draw up a shopping list and only then go to the brain. So what are we going to do about this next problem of non-human versus human consciousness? This is something that people do think about a lot. And it strikes me, if you look at the anatomy of a range of species in the animal kingdom, I would defy anyone to draw a clear Rubicon, a clear anatomical line, where one load of species are disenfranchised as being unconscious and kind of robots, and the other group are highly, well, not highly sentient, but have some kind of inner state. I wouldn't be confident, as you can see here, although the brain's very hugely, the theme is the same, The theme is always the same. It's just variations on a theme that are characterizing the species. So I don't think that we can with confidence point to an area to study. And moreover, and I owe this to a marine biologist who gave up marine biology to take up neuroscience, who worked in my lab for a while, he pointed out this with the octopus. Now, the octopus has a very different type of brain from us, but nonetheless, the octopus vulgaris is sufficiently worthy as to get Home Office, in UK at least, Home Office legislation. That means to say you cannot just cut up an octopus vulgaris if you want to for an experiment. And actually, they have featured a lot in experiments in the old days with, amazingly, with memory discrimination tests. But more recently, this type of octopus showed great prescience in the World Cup. I don't know if you remember Paul. Remember Paul, the octopus? Who obviously was conscious because he predicted the victory of the various teams. Sadly, he died. So clearly a conscious octopus. And yet the Elhedon cirrhosa, apparently a very similar species, you could cut up. So this shows the arbitrary nature of trying to draw a distinction between if an animal is conscious or not conscious. Where do you draw that? If you can't draw the line, you shouldn't draw a line. And therefore, we do have a bit of a riddle going on that actually can relate even more controversially to another scenario. So look, where's the difference? You say this little animal, this dog is doing something outside of the canine repertoire. Normally she'd bite the lady or run away, but the very fact that the dog is doing something humanoid, and we know that dogs aren't humans, the reason I find this rather enchanting little picture is it does suggest the dog has some kind of inner state, and yet somehow it's different from ours, and it doesn't correspond to the behavioral state. So I think the animal consciousness, as I say, leads to a way more controversial issue of fetal consciousness. Is a fetus conscious? It's like asking, is a dog conscious or is a rat conscious? Is a fetus conscious? Now, let's assume, as many have for many years, the null hypothesis. That's to say, we assume the negative. Let's assume it's not conscious. So if that's the case, if the fetus is not conscious, when does it become conscious? Is it as it squidges down the birth canal? Well, that'd be tough if you're born by cesarean section. It means you'll never be conscious. Yeah? Or is it exactly at full term? So that raises the rather strange scenario of parents say, who have a premature baby. They're sitting at home saying, oh, our baby's conscious today, but we might as well go into hospital and see it. It wasn't conscious yesterday. Does that seem likely? No, it doesn't. So as far as the brain's concerned, the oxygen, whether it comes through its own nose or through mum, is not going to be the deciding factor. So when would a fetus become conscious? When it's born, when it's a month old, 2 months old? I'm sure many of you have babies. So I know one person at least has a new baby. And you don't suddenly say, well, so the baby's become conscious all of a sudden. So if you reject the null hypothesis that it's not the manner or timing of birth that is the deciding factor, then surely we have to reject the null hypothesis and entertain the possibility the fetus is conscious. Now, I don't want to get into the ethical issues here. We can if you like, but I'm not here as an ethicist. It's more the issue of this being a very similar question to whether animals are conscious. The same riddle. Is it, when do the lights go on? When do they go on? When do they go off? How can we get around that? Because we need to get around that before we even start looking at the brain if we are trying to understand what we're studying. Well, so the problems, there are more problems, no center for consciousness, non-human, fetal consciousness, how can we explain this? Well, perhaps a clue comes if we look at the actions of anesthesia in removing consciousness. I don't know how many of the clinicians here are familiar with BIS monitoring. I gather in Oxford the anaesthetists don't like it very much. Suffice it to say, it's a system by means of monitoring the brain waves from your skull that gives a number, as on the left, showing the depth, or allegedly showing the depth of anaesthesia. This was developed to prevent unnecessary deaths during anaesthesia and also the rather harrowing experience of being conscious during surgery. So the whole idea is that you can put a number on a level of consciousness. Now, if you can do that, surely that means that it's not all or none. And we've known for a long time, everyone at medical school have learned the levels of anaesthesia and indeed the depths of sleep. And I was reflecting on this when I was on holiday at one stage, and I thought, well, if you can have graded anaesthesia, graded sleep, continuously variable unconsciousness, why can't it be the same for consciousness? Now, if that were the case, that would get us out of a great fix. First of all, it will explain the riddle. A fetus could be conscious, but not as conscious as a child. And a child could be conscious, but not as conscious as an adult. And a rat could be conscious, but not, or octopus conscious, but as not as conscious as a rat. And a rat conscious, but not as conscious as a cat. Cat conscious, not as conscious as a primate. So you have wonderfully now been able to accommodate that riddle. And it also introduces a rather interesting idea that you as an adult human being will be more conscious at some times than at other times. And if you think about our kind of folklore way of talking about consciousness, we talk about raising our consciousness or deepening our consciousness, don't we? It doesn't matter which way you go, whether it's up or down, it doesn't matter. But we're now doing something that scientists love. We're quantifying something, whatever it is. We're now introducing something that potentially we can measure. So I'd like to suggest to you that consciousness is not the lights on or the lights off, but more it's like a dimmer switch. And that consciousness could grow as brains grow. And then you as an adult human being will have different levels. And now, if only we could find a correlation for that process, then indeed neuroscience might be doing something useful. So what we are doing now, we're in search of a process where consciousness is continuously variable. Something like a dimmer switch. Now, what could there be in the brain? Well, let's look at the candidates. Okay, here you have neuroscience presented in one slide, representing the top-down and bottom-up approaches. Here on the left is the so-called bottom-up approach, where, forgive me, neuroscientists, but because a lot of people here are general, they may not have been familiar with these terms. The bottom-up approach, which you can do traditionally with electrodes, looking at the changes in voltage generated across the cell membrane, as seen here, that's great because it has a high time resolution, but you only look at one cell, and you can see those spiky things. They're the signals, the electrical blips that a cell will generate. Now, you could do that, but then we really want something that is going to vary in degree, don't we? And so, therefore, looking at a single cell, which anyway might die, so it wouldn't be very good to have a cell as the center for consciousness, I don't think that's a very good candidate. Similarly, looking at scanning, which I know is brilliantly done here, this is magnetic resonance imaging, and you can see these kind of pictures, I'm sure you're very familiar with them. They tell you about the activity of whole brain regions, but the spatial resolution is quite coarse, and the time resolution is several seconds, whereas on the left, those little blips are a thousandth of a second. So really we want something that can vary in degree, and again, brain regions from 1 second or sub-second to the next won't vary in degree. So what we want is something that links these two. And this has been the holy grail in any event for neuroscience for a long time, reconciling the top-down and the bottom-up approaches with some kind of mesoscale, mid-level process. And if that mid-level process was something that was analog, wasn't all or none, then I would suggest that would be a very fruitful place to start prospecting. So there is such, I wouldn't have set that up if there wasn't such a thing. And I'd like to introduce you to what we call, in my lab, the names vary, so bear with us, but in my lab we call these, this middle level thing that I'm going to explain, we call them neuronal assemblies. Neurons are brain cells, and assemblies are, we're talking as variable, transient, large-scale groups of neurons that are not defined by anatomical systems. So these ideally, this system we're looking for, these assemblies, occur in less than a second, and at the same time, they will recruit large scale, not just a single cell, but up to 10 million or 100 million brain cells. So this is what we're looking for, and what we can do in order to explore this is to use something called voltage-sensitive dye imaging. If you unpack each of those, it's not that complicated. It's simply you give a dye, it embeds itself in the membrane of the cell, and then it will change its wavelength, it will fluoresce as the voltage across the membrane changes. This was pioneered by people like Amram Grinwald at the Weizmann Institute in Israel in the 1990s, and it's a technique that we've now adopted in my lab. Now, the downside of it is you can't use it in humans because you don't want to give a potentially toxic dye onto human brain tissue. But you can use it in animal models, and that's what I'll be showing you. So here we are. This is from my own lab. And I hope you can see. Okay, so this is the edge of the brain. Oh, I need this. Okay, so this is the edge of the brain. And as you might imagine, after a very short electrical stimulation of about a microsecond, you can see these are thousandths of a second, milliseconds. Can you see that very quickly a pattern emerges with a very strong epicenter and then a decaying amount of activity. And all this happens in about 18 milliseconds, 18 thousandths of a second. You would not see that with conventional imaging. Now, it strikes me that this, these neuronal assemblers, and as I say, you can look at how nice they are, that this could be something that could be a potential correlate for understanding variable degrees of consciousness. As you see, it varies in size. And as you can see, it has an epicenter that then decays, a bit like a stone in a puddle. And that's the image, for those of you who are not scientists, try and think of that. What I'm going to try and sell to you as a theory is that consciousness is correlated with the brain equivalent of a stone being thrown in a puddle. The stone is very local, it's very small, and it's quasi-permanent. And yet it would generate much broader, highly evanescent ripples that vastly, the excursion ripples vastly exceeds the stone, but they're gone in a second. And we can vary the extent of the ripples, either with the size of the stone, the force it's thrown, the competition from other stones, but nonetheless, that excursion, whatever it may be, from one moment to the next, it will be different. That could be correlated with degree of consciousness. That's what I'm going to try and suggest to you. So here is another film. Okay, what you're looking at here, before I start the film, this is mouse brain, and this is the plane of section. And then this is what we see in our bath. This is an area of the brain, you don't have to worry about it, where we put our stimulating electrode, but it projects to this outer layer of the brain. And what you're going to see here in this little film is when we stimulate here, the activity in this remoter part of the brain that's been conducted via this connection, and you can follow its trajectory along here. You can see there's something going on here. And you might like to look at the time scale here. Okay, so let's look at that. So can you see the activity shown by the fluorescent blobs? And as we're getting to about 200 milliseconds in this case, there's peak activity that then's gone. And by the time we're still way less than a second, half a second, it's completely gone pretty much after that stimulation. So that's what we work on. That's a neuronal assembly in a dish, and we can therefore study its properties. So if you agree that such things exist and that such things might potentially be good candidates for reconciling top-down and bottom-up, now we can go to the brain and ask it to deliver some things on our shopping list. The first, following the analogy of the stone in the puddle, the first thing we want to know is what is the stone? Now, for neuroscience, that's quite easy, actually. This is an easy one. What could be the stone? Well, very simply, it could be some strong sensory experience. And I defy anyone who says they have a good correlate of consciousness or a theory of consciousness to answer the simple question, undeniable, that an alarm clock wakes you up. Why should an alarm clock wake you up? It will wake up a baby, it will wake up anyone, irrespective of their culture, their language, unless you are, of course, totally, totally tone deaf. As long as your ears are working, an alarm clock will wake you up. Why? This theory would be that this is the equivalent of throwing the stone very forcefully. A very strong throw will generate enough ripples for consciousness. So a sensory experience could be the stone in the puddle. A very noisy or bright light will wake you up. Anything that's very strong will wake you up. But we don't go through life, do we? Just, you know, being woken up by alarm clocks and bright lights. There's another aspect, especially to humans, that I think we need to consider. And I'd like to suggest we're now looking not just at the force with which a stone is thrown, but the size that the stone would be. What could determine how big the stone is? Because the nice thing about this idea, she says modestly, is that there's different factors that we can vary, like force stone is thrown, now the size of the stone. Well, in the human brain, we know there's a lot of potential for so-called hardwired connections. That's a phrase I don't personally like because it does suggest too much analogy with computers, and we can argue the toss over that if you wish later, but I'll use that word anyway to distinguish it from the evanescent assemblies. So if we're talking about something that's quasi-permanent, connections that are quite permanent, as you can see, what characterizes the human brain superlatively, more than any other species. Other species, greater or less extent, will have this facility. We have it superlatively, which is, as you can see, the growth of the connections between brain cells. And it's the growth of connections that characterizes the growth postnatally of the human brain. So that even if, incidentally, you're a clone, an identical twin, you will have a unique configuration of brain cell connections. Why? Because these will be crafted and formed and updated and strengthened and so on by your individual experience as you go through life. So you're born, in the words of the great William James, into a booming, buzzing confusion, and you'll evaluate the world. What else can you do? How sweet, how fast, how cold, how bright? But gradually, as the weeks turn to months, turn to years, as the connections form, an erstwhile abstract visual display will now be a pattern. It'll be your mother's face. And if mum, and let's hope she does, features again and again and again in your life, more connections will form. That face will mean something to you that it does not mean to other people. And there we make the transition from what we call sensory to cognitive, after the Latin cogito, I think. So I'd like to suggest to you that as well as the stone being important in terms of the force with which it's thrown, its size is important. That in turn will reflect your cognitive status. So here you are living your life, downtown Oxford, people think it's like this, where everyone is doing their own thing, and everything you do has its place in space and time. It can't be undone. I'm sure everyone in this room has passed an exam, but you can't unpass it. And it might be that you failed other exams, you didn't make the most of that exam, or it may be that was the start of your career. It doesn't matter. That's an event in space and time that happened to you, that's part of your identity, that may be responsible for many other things that have subsequently occurred. And this sequence of events, this unique life story, this narrative that enables you to see the world in a way that no one else does, to evaluate it in terms of what you've experienced, gets more and more rich and diverse as you go through your life. So you go from this one-way street, how sweet, how fast, how cold, how bright, to a two-way street where everything that happens to you, you evaluate in terms of your previous connections, and at the same time, the ongoing experience will update and upgrade those connections. And this wonderful sequence of events that makes you the person you are, this identity, is leaving its mark literally on your brain. So incidentally, that's what I would call the mind. It's not quite the same as consciousness. It is the personalization of your brain through the unique configuration of brain cell connections that are quasi-permanent. But they are not enough to generate consciousness. They're too local. They're too long-lasting they're too slow to form, these cell connections, to be responsible for the kind of sub-second events that we need to account for. Okay, so I'd like to suggest to you that as well as the force, we have the cognitive experience, which is the degree of neuronal connectivity. These are some of my colleagues in Oxford. I don't know if Professor Fink may or may not recognize them. But for me, this is a very special photo. It was one of those rare occasions we'd signed a contract with the university for money. And that's why everyone's looking vaguely nervous and smiling at the same time. Yeah? Now, for you, looking at this, you didn't know that. You'll just see this as generic middle-aged men in suits and ties. You'd say they were typical scientists, probably, and that's about as far as you'd go. Whereas for me, I know the names of all these people. I know, you know, a lot of their dreams and hopes and problems and worries. And this day in particular was a very special day. It's triggering in my brain, even as I look at it now, one person of this has died, many, many thoughts and feelings that you won't have. You'll just see this as a rather boring picture of a load of old middle-aged people just standing in a row. Whereas for me, it's very special. It means something. So this cognitive experience is due to the connectivity of my brain. So we've got, then, the stone. We've worked out how it can be thrown, and that being a variable. We've worked out what could be the size of the stone. Now we get back to the nitty-gritty. How does the assembly actually form? How do those ripples get generated when you throw the stone? Why should an activated hub of cells, let's say to an alarm clock, let's say to your mother's face, why should that then generate and recruit a large-scale coalition of brain cells? Well, we need to know something else about the brain. Again, I'm aware I'm talking to a split audience of highly specialists and perhaps people who are less familiar. But all you need to notice about this are these kind of chemical fountains in the brain. Don't worry about the names. You may recognize serotonin as one of the agents that's the target for Prozac, for depression, antidepressant drugs. So these chemical fountains, these amines in the brain, are actually very diffuse, as you can see. They go everywhere. And they are related to sleep-wake cycles, to arousal levels. And this has been known for quite a long time. Less well known is the way they work. The way they work is not so much as one-on-one chemical messengers. They're not really equipped, if you look at the distribution, to do that so easily. But now in neuroscience, we've spoken for the last decade or two about modulators. And a modulator is a chemical it can be a transmitter as well, but a modulator is a chemical that predisposes a cell, usually makes it more sensitive to a response, but you then need the response. This is the one technical picture I'm going to show you of one of those agents, acetylcholine, acting as a modulator. Bear with me, if you're not a neuroscientist, all you need notice is that when acetylcholine is present in the two lines in the center, there's more action potentials, there's more blips. That's what modulation is. Even though the stimulus in each case, that's to say this kind of rectangular box at the bottom or the blob on the top one, that's the same. I hope you'll appreciate that acetylcholine, in itself not doing anything, has made it easier for the cell to generate blips. We can go into the biophysics there if you wish in the Q&A, but I don't think it's necessary. All you need to know is that these agents that are responsible for arousal and wakefulness can predispose cells to respond in a different way. They will give you a variant response to an invariant input. And that's how I personally would define modulation. So let's put that to work. Here you are seeing your mum, and that's what we could call an epicenter, as shown with E. The square shows a hub of cells that are hardwired, as I've said, because of your exposure and interaction with mum. You see her. So we've got now the stone being thrown in the puddle. In this case, it would be highly cognitive. It would be a big stone. If your mum is shouting at you, or if she's wearing kind of gold lamé dress, or she's holding alarm clocks or something like this, then that will also add to the sensory component. But it will be a payoff between sensory and cognitive, the two together. Now what happens is those hub brain cells that we saw, those fountains, will be releasing chemicals in a very diffuse way, as we saw. And according to your state of arousal, then that will determine how efficient they are in stimulating now, or enabling the stimulation of the epicenter to recruit the assembly around them. So we can see there's three factors. There's the size of the stone, there's the force with which it's thrown, and there's now the modulators that will enable the recruitment of further cells even after the hardwired cells have been activated. So that is how an assembly could be generated. So let's just very briefly look at the empirical characterizations. Amy, sorry, this is the only time I'll need you. Okay. Can you just do the thing again? Sorry, I'm sorry. So here what you see, okay, is here, these are the brain slices again. TTX is an agent that blocks those electrical blips. So in theory, it should block out assembly, and it does. And then these other things here are the sort of things people like doing in pharmacology departments, which is trying to show a specificity according to certain chemical messengers and their molecular targets. So again, we don't have to worry, but all you need to appreciate is that the one on the right is less than the ones on the left, and that the one on the top hasn't shown any activity at all. For those of you who like this kind of thing, that shows that it is physiological rather than just some kind of passive current spread. Okay, so that's the kind of characterization we do in my lab, and the sort of things we can understand about the nuts and bolts of those assemblies. What about the explanations of this? Now let's go back to our problems. So we've still got problems. So far, we've got round the issue of not having a center for consciousness. We've got round the issue of non-human and fetal consciousness. And we've talked about the action of anesthesia in terms of a reduction in assembly size or depth of consciousness. Now, and I know there's lots of people here who are working on the modalities. We had a very interesting session earlier this afternoon. I'd like to suggest to you one of the big problems as well is the qualitative difference between hearing and vision. Now, there are some people who can muddle up the two, but most people know very clearly when they're seeing something as opposed to when they're hearing something. They're two very different subjective experiences. And yet, in brain terms, once you go past the cochlea or the retina, the language of the brain is the same. In both cases, after the light has activated the retina or sound waves, the cochlea, they are transduced, they're translated into those electrical blips again, the same language. And they're treated in the same way, more or less. So if they are processed in the same way, in the same kind of code or language, when and how does the qualitative difference, when and how does the subjective difference between hearing and vision come about? How come you hear and see very differently, and yet the brain is treating it the same way? And if we knew that, if we knew how to account for that subjective discrepancy, then surely that would help us understand, again, the question, the problem that we've posed ourselves. So this is hearing and vision, just in case you didn't know what it was. So what we did in the lab was to see Because with conventional neuroscience, although the brain regions are slightly different, to the best of my knowledge, there haven't been very clear differences that one can really start to build a theory on. So we looked at the difference between the visual part of the brain and the hearing part of the brain to see if the assemblies there might be any different. And we found something quite interesting. First of all, these are 11 experiments using the visual system. And I think now you're getting quite used to assemblies now by looking at them. So this is the edge of the brain. This is the stimulating electrode directly applied. This is the visual area shown here. And you can see that there is a pattern whereby the epicenter, the most active area, is, as it happens, down here. This means it's in the deeper layer of the brain, like that. Now, this difference was only apparent, or this pattern was only apparent, after about 300 milliseconds. Contrast it with the auditory system, where, having started out the same, at 300 milliseconds, we now see a polar opposite. It's at the edge here. Now, that might be a start, and it might be interesting. Then we have a real problem. What's the problem? It's not to do with the physiology, not to do with comparing the visual and auditory cortices. No, that's not the problem. The problem is, how do we translate it to the phenomenology? How, if we've got the same yardstick for hearing and vision in neuroscience terms, where we can see differences, what's the yardstick that we can use phenomenologically for hearing versus vision? And I mean, if you spoke to a Martian, how would you distinguish a hearing experience from a visual experience to them, I wonder, without being tautologists? And I was agonizing about this, and then one day it struck me that perhaps, just perhaps, when you hear something, it's primarily, but I stress not exclusively, it's primarily a discrepancy in time, detection of discrepancies in time, whereas vision is primarily, but not exclusively, primarily a discrepancy in space. Now, if that was the case, if we're after the same yardstick, could we not put the two together and talk about a space-time manifold, which physicists like to do? That's to say, where space and time are on a continuum, where you can talk about them in the same breath, as it were. And if that was the case, could we use space-time as a way for matching up the discrepancies we've seen here to try and understand it? Now, this involves relativity theory, about which I know nothing. And I'm therefore in search of a physicist or anyone who can model these kinds of things, who really knows about relativity theory, because one has one's own limits in neuroscience. I just can't do this. And I would love to try and understand how these physiological differences which we're observing might relate to space-time as a manifold. Okay, so again, back to more of a neuroscience approach. You might say, well, that's fine, all this kind of dancing around in brain slices, all very pretty, you know, it's nice pharmacology and so on, but surely we're interested in function. And indeed we are. What we want to do is extrapolate. We want to extrapolate from a brain slice, which we can manipulate very easily with a very high time resolution. We want to extrapolate up here, but here there's a very slow time resolution we've seen. So we have to go on a rather circuitous route, ideally. Not that we've done this yet. What we need to do is to, in a whole animal, be able to apply our in vivo imaging, which we can do because we can look at rat brains. And at the same time, a whole animal rat could be used for fMRI. So we might be able to start to extrapolate, when we see one kind of thing, what it might mean elsewhere. And that's my long-term hope. But in the short term, we've got as far as doing it so-called in vivo, that's to say in an anaesthetized animal. And you can see very happily just what one would have predicted, that with deep anaesthesia, here's the assembly. Sorry, we'll start with the light. The animal has to be anaesthetized, obviously, because it's an invasive procedure. But as we deepen the anaesthesia, you can see the assembly is reducing in amplitude and latency and in size here. And you can see it here, which is what you would predict if anaesthesia worked by reducing the size of the assemblies. That's what you would indeed predict. But you say, well, can these actually be linked to consciousness? Can an assembly actually? So it's all very well, this neuroscience. And until recently, all I could do was suggest that this could be a candidate correlation. Until in the summer of last year, I was delighted to get contacted by the press in relation to someone called Brian Pollard's work. I don't know if anyone's familiar with this. And this was from his work last year, there's the reference, where he's introduced a new type of imaging that is not invasive, it can be used in humans, and yet it has a very fast time resolution. I won't begin to understand the technicalities. I would suggest, because I'm not Professor Pollard and he's not here, you could look up the actual mechanics of what he's doing, but that's his colleague, who looks a bit miserable there, actually, as humour can, looks a bit sad. But what was very nice, and quite not always the case in science, was he actually acknowledged me, and this is from a quote from the Daily Mail, not, it's a bit like your Daily Telegraph, the Daily Mail, so if you've made it in there, you know you've done quite well. So lead researcher Brian Pollard, University of Manchester, said the finds appear to support hypothesis put forward by me at Oxford about the nature of consciousness itself. And that, for me, was a very gracious thing for him to do. He didn't have to acknowledge me, as we all know, with the backstabbing that we call science politics. You know what Kissinger said? Why university politics is so spiteful because the stakes are so low. Do you remember that quote from Kissinger? And we've all been victims of that. But nonetheless, I wanted to thank him very much for... But nonetheless, it shows that this idea, which is still very much in its infancy, might have some traction and might have some clear relation to consciousness. So I'd like to end by now applying it. If this stone in the puddle model, these assemblies, can indeed serve as a correlate, it's not water into wine, it's not causally linked, but if it's a correlate, if it's a good correlate, we should be able to go from physiology to phenomenology, and we should be able to go from phenomenology to physiology. So let's see if we can do that. Let's go first with the physiology. And as always in science, what you want to do is to think of caricature scenarios, because we always work with an exaggerated situation. So let's imagine, for some reason, you had an abnormally small assembly. What can we predict the kind of consciousness you would have? Now, fortunately, there's many ways in which you could have a small assembly. One might be childhood, which we saw has very modest connectivity. Another might be dreaming, where, whilst an alarm clock wake you up, you won't be woken up with a dream because the sensory stimulation is so weak, it's just dependent on the intrinsic activity of the brain rather than being externally driven. Another might be schizophrenia, where there is an abnormal modulation, particularly of dopamine, those chemical fountains. Another might be fast-paced sports, where you have competing assemblies. So now the assemblies can't form because they're displaced by another. And finally, I don't know if you call them, I don't know if the young people in the audience wince at me calling them raves. In my day, we call them raves. These are events where you go into a world stripped of all cognitive content and just go, oh, techno, 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 techno. And yes, well, okay, so they're still called raves, good. So there's no cognitive content. You're putting a premium on the senses, and some people, misguidedly, of course, will be taking agents that interfere with the chemical messengers, with the connections, so the assembly can't form as well, nor is there any cognitive content, so you have a small assembly. Now, what kind of consciousness would all these things have in common? I'm not saying that children are schizophrenic, although there are similarities with children with schizophrenia. They can't interpret proverbs, they have a short attention span, they're easily distracted, and they have an underfunctioning frontal part of the brain called the prefrontal cortex, which only comes on stream in late teenage years. So can we think of the type, can we try and describe it, what it might be? Well, clearly, it would be something I would suggest that's characterized by emotional content, not cognitive, something that is very dependent on reactivity to the outside world. And for these different reasons, you would end up with a small assembly. That would be the net effect, but you can see the reasons would be different. But again, why I like my own theory, of course, because it's my own theory, is because you can vary the factors or the variables to have the same effect. And that means you can, and we'll come on to this, differentially manipulate them. So if we're thinking about that, thinking about being very excited, because we saw it was related to arousal, addiction, I'm afraid, if we're talking about drugs, and reward, this is a reward, in case you don't know what rewards are like. In all cases, the chemical that features to help bring about these global brain states is the chemical dopamine. And dopamine, we know, and this is again from my own lab, inhibits activity in the prefrontal cortex. And you can see here the assembly. Apomorphine, for the non-aficionados, is an agent that stimulates the targets, the little molecular targets for dopamine. And you can see it's diminished the size. So we know it inhibits, and this has been done in many other ways, ours is with assemblies showing that. So if that's the case, could we imagine a scenario where you have a shut-down prefrontal cortex, lots of dopamine, and you're in a world. You're in a world of yuck and wow and speeding and partying and wine, women and song and drugs and sex and rock and roll, where you've abrogated your sense of self. You've let yourself go. You've blown your mind. You're out of your mind. The very word ecstasy in Greek is to stand outside of yourself. You no longer have that identity, that carefully crafted identity. For this moment, you are the recipient of your senses, like a small child. So could it be, here we are, this is a rave, this could be a hypoactive and underactive prefrontal cortex might be a factor in the small assembly mode along with the dopamine. Could we go the other way then? If we characterize a small assembly as being highly emotional, interdependent with the outside world. Can you imagine something where there's a flattening of effect, a numbing of emotion? The outside world seems grey and remote, and I'm sure people who are in the business will recognise this immediately as clinical depression. Again, an aberration in those modulating fountains. So if that's the case, one could say an imbalance of the chemical fountains leads to a lack of pleasure. The clinicians here will know, psychiatrists will know, that depression is associated with so-called anhedonia. That literally means a lack of pleasure. Whilst the wine, women, and song scenario presumably is pleasure, anhedonia is a lack of emotion. The person feels numb. They just feel emotionally numb. The world is grey and remote. The large assembly. That in turn generates two hypotheses. This is Fragonard's swing. This is someone, we talk about being abandoned. This is someone in small assembly mode, Fragonard's swing, I'd say. So therefore, the greater the neuronal assembly, the less emotion. And the corollary of that is that emotion is the most basic form of consciousness. Now, that's hardly surprising. You only have to look at the tail-wagging dog or the purring cat or the gurgling baby who don't have high cognitive content but clearly are experiencing something or feeling something. Can we go the other way now, from phenomenology to physiology? Well, sadly, what we've all experienced is pain. And I want to suggest to you that the degree of pain you subjectively feel is related to the size of assembly. Here's the suggestions why. Pain is largely expressed as other associations, pricking, stabbing, burning. We see it in terms of other things. There's a diurnal threshold to pain. There's this terrible experiment, rather sad, must have been on bankrupt medical students, where you put electric shocks through their teeth at different times of the day, and they have to report when they feel the pain. And in case you're interested, it's easiest in the middle of the day. That's when your pain threshold is highest. Now, that's not because the conduction velocity of the pain fibers is changing. It's because, again, I would suggest those modulators are fluctuating on a diurnal basis. If you anticipate pain, it feels greater. Phantom limb pain, a Mount Second Wall, you'll be familiar with, I would call what they called a neuronal matrix, an assembly, where signals coming in, signaling that the feedback from your limb, the so-called proprioceptive feedback, that a limb should be there is absent, phantom limb, causing phantom limb pain. Pain is largely absent in dreams, which I've suggested a small assembly state, and morphine, the very well-known analgesic, allegedly gives you a dreamlike euphoria. And what's very interesting is apparently people on morphine say they feel the pain, but it no longer matters. It no longer is significant. They're not seeing it in terms of other things. And we know that morphine works via naturally occurring chemical targets where it acts as an imposter to other chemical messengers and will reduce the size of the assembly. Schizophrenia, I don't know who would do these experiments, but they have been done. Schizophrenic people, where I've suggested there's a small assembly state, they have a very high threshold to pain. Why you'd want to give pain to people who are schizophrenic, I don't know. Similarly, it's well known in depression, and this has actually been done formally as well, depressed people have a very low threshold for pain, which I'm suggesting is a large assembly state. So that sort of fits. And finally, as we've seen, anesthetic actions, which previously no one's really explained how they can deprive you of consciousness because they vary hugely in their structure and their actual mechanism of work. If we go to the mesoscale and posit that it's because they reduce the size, as we've seen, that would also fit. It would also give rise to the rather odd idea that if the anesthetic, as it was wearing on, wasn't very efficient and was doing this slowly, during anesthesia, you should go through small assembly mode. So is it not a crazy idea that as you're being anesthetized, you become perhaps aroused, slightly mad? And that's, in fact, what you do. The classic stages of anesthesia are hyperexcitability and mania. Would it be pleasurable? Well, in the old days, people took low doses of anesthesia as ether frolics, or you'd take nitrous oxide at fairs. And even now, ketamine, a drug of abuse, is an anesthetic. So there is this counterintuitive idea that I think is valid nonetheless, that low-dose anesthesia or slow-acting anesthesia might take you through the small assembly mode. So what does the future hold? Well, I think that by using optical imaging, we could reveal factors, or the sort of imaging that Professor Pollard has shown, that govern the formation of these highly transient and therefore erstwhile elusive assemblies. And this model could be linked to link the phenomenology with the physiology, to be a correlation, as I promised. So degree of neuronal activity is the physiology. We call that intensity of the senses phenomenologically. Extent of pre-associating associations, the physiology, significance, what your mum means to you phenomenologically. Availability of modulators, arousal. Availability of predisposition or mood, like hormones. Formation of competing assemblies, distractions, such as we might get in sports. Input from the prefrontal cortex, what we would call narrative, or your life story, that is then abolished with your identity. And then you could do this kind of thing, which obviously I'm not going to go through, but just on the top, I hope you can see that this is the physiology, and here is the phenomenology, and you can make predictions by playing around with whether they're high or low, predicting the assembly size. Now, and then correlating with the condition. Now, I do not care if this is right or wrong, but I do care passionately that it's falsifiable, that it's testable. And that's where neuroscience can come in. It can actually generate a falsifiable hypothesis, which is really all that you ask of science. Yeah? You don't have to be right or wrong, but you do have to be able to empirically test something. And whilst we're not quite there yet, this is the kind of thing that I suggest neuroscience can do for the study of correlations of consciousness. But we mustn't forget that a brain is not in a vat. It's actually in a body, and therefore it has to work with the immune system and the endocrine system and the autonomic nervous system. Otherwise, you'd have biological anarchy, wouldn't you? So that they must all work together. And this, some of you may be familiar with the work of Antonio Damasio, who's done a lot of work on so-called body markers, somatic markers, trying to posit a cohesion between the great control systems of the body and indeed the peripheral, how it works. And I'd like to suggest that really an assembly is not consciousness. It's not, in a dish, it's not going to generate consciousness. It's an index of consciousness. So what could happen is you have your hub of brain cells. The stone is thrown either by sensory stimulation or by the extent of associations. That's to say the cognitive content and the sensory content. Other modulators will be available according to arousal levels or time of day. Hormones, which we haven't gone into. But all these agents will aid and abet the facility of this hardwired hub of cells to recruit an assembly. And again, another factor will be the formation of competing assemblies. But that isn't consciousness. That's an index of consciousness. What I then suggest happens is that signature, that unique signature, is read out to the rest of the body through chemicals called peptides, which are co-localized with conventional chemical messengers that can be trilingual in terms of these other control systems of the body. And these circulate round, and indeed from the rest of the body, they feed back. So one has this iteration of these very multilingual chemicals that iterate round, and eventually, moment to moment, subsecond to subsecond, according to all these different things going on, your assembly size will be shrinking or expanding, and that is determining your degree of consciousness. This is described in a far less garbled way. This is a shameless plug for my book, Private Life of the Brain, which was out a while ago, but it's still going strong on Amazon, I'm delighted to see, although I'm writing a new one this year. But if you want more details, it's in there. But I think the most important slide is this one. First of all, look at how how male scientists are portrayed. Look at them. Yeah, they're fat, they're bald, yeah, dubious clothes. Yeah. Anyway, so here we have, let's say, the physiology and here the phenomenology. And then this is the issue. Yeah, we can do the water, we can do the wine, and I hope I've shown you, we can make some progress to seeing how these two co-vary. How one causes the other, I think you should be more explicit here in step two. Yeah? And I'd like to leave you with this question, not on how the miracle is solved, but what would be the miracle? If I said to you, actually, I've just thought of how the brain generates consciousness, I've now got the causal link, what would you expect me to show you? What am I going to show you? Is it going to be a performing rat? Is it going to be a brain scan? Is it going to be you suddenly feeling like me? Is it going to be a formula? What's it going to be? And I would defy anyone. I've yet to meet anyone who has an idea, even given infinite resources, money, future, whatever, what kind of thing would satisfy that claim? Because if I built a time travel machine, you'd know what to expect. If I built a perpetual motion machine, you'd know what to expect. Built an idea of how the brain generates consciousness, what do you expect? What exactly? How does that reporting go on to this inner person, inner thing? Where does it stop? So I think that whilst neuroscience can really deliver on understanding psychiatric conditions, different mental conditions, the human brain in general, it can help us look at correlations and appreciate the processes. What we cannot as yet do is answer the miracle, but I think we could write science fiction novels if we wished as to what kind of answer we might one day expect. Thank you very much.
So Thanks very much, Susan, for a really erudite presentation. We're actually going to protect you from the slings and arrows of questions for a few minutes,
okay,
and actually have an alternative forum, a discussion panel, and I'd like to invite our discussants as well as Susan to take the stage, please. Our discussants are firstly Professor James Angus, who is Dean of the Faculty of Medicine, Dentistry and Health Sciences, Professor Rufus Black, who is Master of Ormond College, and is also a theologian, ethicist and strategic advisor. Professor Lowen Skeen, who is a professor in the Faculty of Law at the University of Melbourne, and Professor Philip Smith, who is head of the School of Psychological Sciences. So perhaps I can cut right to the chase, Rufus Black, and you as a theologian and philosopher, does this cut the mustard for you in terms of Susan saying, well, consciousness is something which is quantifiable and from a developmental perspective is iterative? And is that really iconoclastic for a theologian, or is she talking about something parallel to what's really important to you? Is she talking about awareness, and is what's important to you the concept of self? And if so, where do the two come together?
My task, I guess, as a modern liberal theologian is to make sense of the science and to try and connect it with the larger understandings that we're wanting to have about the self and the nature of reality. And the picture Susan paints, I think, is for a theologian an extremely exciting one because it's an expected one. Now, to some theologians it may not be, but to a modern liberal theologian I think it is. And it is in a number of really important ways. The first one is that modern liberal theologian expects that complex systems will emerge new states, phenomena that are larger, that are more than the sum of the parts. And the picture we've been painted here is of consciousness as something more than the sum of the parts. It is actually an emergent phenomena from a complex system. We see that in all sorts of other aspects of reality. We'd expect it to be what consciousness was. So there's one aspect of it which says this is deeply consistent with the way the world as a whole presents and what we'd expect. The second thing is it says it's evolutionary, which we'd also expect and celebrate, and in lots of ways solve some complicated problems that theology struggled with, which is, how, in a meaningful sense, can we describe, and I use the word kind of without, a bit like avoiding the kind of defining consciousness, how can we talk about animals and people both having souls and also fetuses having souls? Well, I think Susan provides us with a way of beginning an explanation, which is to say the soul is the soul, or the enduring features of the mind is an evolutionary reality that emerges both in different life, in different animal life forms, and in people in an evolutionary journey. That explains, provides a way, a scientific way into a very, very, very difficult question. It also explains perhaps one other piece, which is important, and it has a moral kind of component to it, which is once we kind of recognise consciousness has this continuum, this evolutionary continuum to it, the nature of empathy and obligation to other conscious selves becomes something we can start to tackle in a really interesting way that I think in modern times, as we've started to appreciate the consciousness of animals, though theologians have always maintained animals have souls, that gives rise to an ability to join in a communion of some form without wanting to kind of make any metaphysical connections between conscious beings, and also holds out the possibility that the shape of the universe is an ongoing evolution that emerges ever higher order forms of consciousness.
So if I interpret what you just said correctly, you're sort of looking at empathy as a perspective of self in a societal structure, and it's got an evolutionary dynamic and sense to it in that from a Darwinian perspective, it provides a survival advantage. Would that be a fair view of what you're saying?
Well, I guess what I'd want to say is that by whatever Darwinian means it might have come to be, it emerges as a phenomenon that's larger than the Darwinian forces that created it. And therefore, I think, you know, the lovely thing about consciousness as an emergent phenomena is it enables us simultaneously to say, to not dispute the science at all, but to recognise that this phenomena itself is not wholly described by the science, and therefore we can look to it, whether it is in ethical or thinking about the nature of beauty or truth or any other quality, to have its own attributes that are not only describable by science, and therefore a place for the humanities.
Okay, thank you. Phil Smith, your perspective. You have a strong mathematical background, and we've talked about complexity here, and as scientists, sometimes we like to take a reductionist view of things. What do you believe that computation and mathematics has to offer the field of consciousness?
Let me say as a preamble, Trevor, that I strongly resonated with Susan's final conclusion, which is not only don't we know the solution, but just at the moment we don't actually know what a solution would look like. So I'm interested in neural computation, the sorts of computational activities performed by neurons, which I think are a correlate of Susan's neural assemblies, as the basis for cognition, for processes like perception, attention, memory, and decision making. And I think there is a lot that we now understand about that, the theory of nonlinear dynamics, nonlinear systems. We can talk in very sensible ways about the kinds of computations that the brain performs. They're massively parallel, they're plastic, they're highly nonlinear, and we can build systems which exhibit those sorts of properties, which can solve complex problems in learning, pattern recognition, and classification. So I'm optimistic about our ability to continue to further understand the kinds of computations that real brains carry out that can translate perception into action. But that begs the issue of the qualia, the subjectivity that Susan talked about. What we don't know is why, as a matter of fact, when those computations are carried out as a brain, within a brain, within the bath of neurochemicals that is the substrate of neural computation, that it produces something like consciousness. And just give a sense of why I'm pessimistic, let's do a little thought experiment. Let's imagine something like the Blue Gene Project in Lausanne, Switzerland, where they have brought the power of an IBM Blue Gene computer to simulating a little slice of neocortex tissue with great neural realism, great fidelity. So everything that we know about morphology, transmitter substances, ion channels, and all the rest of it. Now, let's imagine that we could do this, scale it up to something like the size of a whole brain, as they aspire to do. And let's imagine that that simulation started to exhibit all of the hallmarks of intelligent behaviour, that it passed a Turing test, it started following a football team, it started to express prejudicial views about people who sing French songs in public transport. We might start to treat that with a certain amount of deference and circumspection and say that seems to be behaving intelligently, at least according to behavioural criteria of intelligence. But the question then, is it conscious? I would argue is undecidable. And this goes to why this is the hard question philosophically and why we don't, as Susan emphasised at the end, even have a sense of what the answer to the question would look like.
Okay, thank you. All right, well, let's change tack slightly. James Angus, you're, in addition to being dean, a pharmacologist. And how does this resonate with you? Susan mentioned so-called modulators and their importance in, you know, the journey in relation to modifying our perspectives, our arousal, our consciousness, etc. You know, on that continuum of awareness, consciousness, cognition, cognitive enhancement, where do we draw the line in terms of tinkering? You know, what are the perspectives we should adopt? Who should make the decisions? What's fair game? And what are the demands on educators in terms of empowering the next generation of health professionals in terms of how to deal with these contingencies which are going to be before us in the next generation and beyond?
Well, thank you, Trevor, for those 20 questions. Let me start as a pharmacologist. There is the axiom, the known truth, that every drug has more than one action, because no drug has ever been proven to have only one action. And of course, it's about the dose or concentration as to whether or not it will have the specific action you think it might have at that site. So this is extraordinarily complex. And Susan was right to say that pharmacologists like to tinker in organ bars because you can control the concentration and you can control the phenomenon because you're only testing one thing. And if you get a yes or no answer, you've progressed. If it's a maybe, back to the drawing board. So what she's shown for me today is that in this incredibly complex area, when you start from intact man, intact brain, trying to go right down to the cell, the molecular, submolecular level even, what you're doing when you get down to that level is really increasing the power of the experiment, the analytical power. But what a pharmacologist has to do is not only be able to do that experiment, but to take it back into the whole. And that's where the pharmacologist working with the physiologist and the neuroscientist with the new techniques is going to add value. But where should we start with these mind-bending drugs? Should we actually develop a drug for a normal person and increase your memory, let's say? That's a hell of a call today, because what is the assay? As Philip rightly says, what are we going to try and measure at the end? And if it's a yes or no, maybe you'll get there. But if it's a maybe answer and it's just more phenomenon, you haven't answered anybody's question. Should we have such drugs? Who's going to put them on the market? Who's going to do the science? And I come back to the point is it's going to have a very different effect in probably every person who are normal to start with, let's say, forget about whether they have some disease. And the simple things like just increasing your memory could, of course, be improved by your blood flow. And if you're fit, that might be enough to give you that increased 10%, 5% in your modulator that might affect increasing your cognate activity or your memory.
Thank you. And Lawrence Keane, as a lawyer, surely as these issues are much, much more deeply interrogated, you know, there are challenges for the community which emerge. And I guess two which come to mind are the end-of-life issues, the question of vegetative state, you know, sort of the concept of when someone is actually deceased. And a second is really a perspective of the issue of free will and predeterminism. And where are we in terms of the legal perspective of this at this stage? And do there need to be revisions which are put in place as we inexorably get a more fundamental understanding of the molecular and cellular architecture of the brain?
Well, thank you for those questions. I'm glad I get the easy ones. To reverse them, the law has in fact given a great deal of thought to placing responsibility for people's actions on people who do those things. And so generally responsibility will not be imposed unless a person has acted deliberately. And this is the concept of the guilty minds. So if a person is able to show at the time that they did what would otherwise be a crime, that they were sleepwalking, for example, or that they were mentally ill, that would deny the guilty mind, the mens rea, which would be necessary to prove as part of the crime, and they would then be acquitted. So there's a lot of jurisprudence on that issue. But the second issue is the one where neuroscience is coming more before the courts. And in the about 2005, when I was spending some time in Oxford at the Oxford Martin School, then called the Oxford Martin 21st Century School, I went to a lecture by a neuroscientist whom I'm sure that Susan will know, Professor Adrian Owen. Oh, yes. And he described some work that he had done on patients where they weren't sure whether they were in persistent vegetative state, which is now in Australia called post-coma unresponsiveness, or minimally conscious state. And this is very important for the law because the law treatment can be withdrawn from a patient who's in a persistent vegetative state on the basis that it's not in the patient's best interests to continue treatment that is futile. So he took a number of these patients, 17, and he gave them fMRI, a brain scan, and to see whether they would respond to direction. And if he asked them, imagine playing tennis, which is a motor activity, this stimulated activity in one part of the brain. And if he said, imagine that you are walking from room to room in your house, a spatial concept, that would stimulate another part of the brain. So if I asked any of you to do this exercise, this would be observable objectively by people who are able to do brain scans. And he found that 17 of these people who might have otherwise qualified to have the treatment withdrawn responded to this test. Now, that's very interesting in itself, but it makes you wonder what might be the consequence of that. And in fact, I became very interested in this and wrote an article with some of my Oxford colleagues about the legal consequences of this, because in England, before life-sustaining treatment is withdrawn, it goes to a court, the Court of Protection. And one of these cases had already arisen, referring to this type of research that Professor Owen had done. And the application was made that the patient who was otherwise going to have treatment withdrawn should have fMRI. So is this something, I mean, even if this were the case, I think this is where the law has not really got going. If this were the case, that a person in this very modified way could respond to directions and had that degree of consciousness, what is the significance of that? And we could still say that even if that is the case, it's still not in the person's best interests to continue the treatment. In fact, it would be better if we were looking at the association between that level of consciousness and general prognosis. So I think that this raises real challenges for the law, and we're only just starting to consider them.
And what about the issue of premeditation versus irresponsibility? And, for example, the perspective of a large frontal meningioma affecting that prefrontal cortex, which Susan talked about. And that, I would have thought, might be seen as 2012 as mitigating circumstance in terms of behaviour. If you could show that MRI scan with that 5 or 6 centimetre meningioma, as opposed to the person who has a completely disrupted microarchitecture of the prefrontal cortex, whereby the chemical structure is just changed in exactly the same way, but you can't see the differences macroscopically. What do you see as the differences between the two, and what are going to be the challenges for the future in terms of that dynamic?
Yes, well, we've already had this issue arise with regard to a genetic predisposition to violence. And there has been at least one case where in Holland where a gene was found that indicated that this person was, that correlated with this person being violent. And so should this be a defence? All the people in this family who had this genetic mutation had offended and were violent, and the ones in the same family who didn't have it led good, upright lives. So what should be the significance of this? It's the same sort of issue that you've just described. And some people would say, well, if you know this, you have this genetic predisposition, and you could take this into a neuroscience concept as well, if you know that you're a person of this type, then there's an even greater responsibility on you to make sure that you don't put yourself in a position where you might be violent. And so instead of being exculpatory, it could either be irrelevant or it could make it even worse if you know that you have this predisposition.
Wise comments. I'll throw it open to the audience now. Any questions of our panel, and in particular Professor Greenfield?
Thanks very much, Trevor. And Susan, thank you for, I think, quite an inspirational talk about consciousness. Could I just explore that a bit further, the issue of consciousness and the relationship between consciousness, awareness, and we only just touched on it, self, and Rufus, soul. You've, I think, got quite an exciting possible measure of consciousness, and we've got cruder ones, I suppose, like EEG with sleep and its paradigm with anaesthesia, etc. Could I throw the challenge to you and you just explore a bit? Do you think there is a possibility that we could get some objective measure of self? Because I always think, I love your idea that there's a continuum of consciousness, so I always think the first cell and two cells got together through the first synapse, were they conscious? And did they think of themselves as cells? And indeed, do unicellular organisms now think of themselves as cells? And if you could provide us with a measure of that, I think we'd all be eternally grateful.
Don't know if we would. Okay, so thank you for that. It's not just any old cells, they're neurons. And I think that what you need is not just any old cell, as in the amoeba, but you need specialised cells, that is to say neurons, that communicate via the systems that we all know. So I would suggest that once you have a kind of nervous system, however rudimentary, you have the potential for some kind of inner state. That's all. Now, obviously, that won't be self-consciousness. It won't be consciousness anyway, such as we all experience. But I think we can't exclude the possibility of some kind of sentient inner state, even in the octopus or creatures that have nervous systems very different from our own, or when those nervous systems are very early on in development. So they would not have a sense of self. The self-consciousness, which, let's be honest, we can lose self-consciousness sometimes while still being conscious. Anyone who likes dancing knows that it's the death knell if you're self-conscious when you're dancing. Yeah? So we all pay money, actually, to put ourselves in situations where we lose our self-consciousness. Yeah? We let ourselves go. We blow our minds. We have a sensational time. If I said, let's go out now, Jeff, and have a cognitive time. Yeah, let's off we go. Yeah, I don't think... perhaps that's what you're having now, I don't know. But on the whole, wine, women and song, drugs and sex and rock and roll, which I would suggest are abrogations of identity, however temporary, the crime passionnel, for example, in French, those examples would be the small assembly mode. So if you can sometimes not have an identity when you let yourself go, that does suggest it's an add-on. It's an add-on to ordinary consciousness. And I would suggest that add-on is a larger assembly. It's a larger, it's just simply a bigger scale assembly of which most species are not capable, but we, of course, are. The subconscious, I would suggest, are subsets of an assembly that in themselves are not sufficiently extensive to dominate a consciousness, but would contribute to it, as indeed we know is the case. So I'm quite comfortable with these subdivisions of assemblies accounting for these nuances in types of consciousness. Now, with awareness, again, one can play around with the semantics. But for those of you who are interested, one of my adversaries, of the many adversaries I have, of course, one is a guy called Christoph Koch, you may have heard of, who focuses on the content of consciousness, on what you are aware of. And if you're interested in that debate, in Scientific American, October 2007, we wrote a joint piece where he and I set out our stalls in opposition to each other. So, and it's written for the general public, so you may find that relevant, because I don't really slag off Christoph because he's not here, it's not fair. So you'll see his two things. But my own view is that you can't talk about visual consciousness divorced from others and so on. And the content of consciousness, for me, isn't as high a priority a question. Awareness is not high priority a question as the difference between consciousness and unconsciousness, the hard problem. That's what really gets me.
Final question, John Finnis.
If we consider the blue gene project analogy, where we say that we can't decide whether the blue gene machine has consciousness or not, although it has many of the external attributes of having consciousness, if we take that argument further, I could say of the person next to me, who I've never met before, that I don't know whether she has consciousness. I know I have consciousness. All I know is she displays attributes of consciousness that I associate with consciousness. But she might be an automaton, for all I know, and maybe. But so I cannot decide on consciousness in another person except by analogy. So I can decide in consciousness in a machine by analogy. Therefore, consciousness becomes a very personal thing that I can decide on, I can define for myself. But I am not in the position where I can define it for any other person.
Mr.
I think we'll start with Philip and give Susan the final word.
Okay.
Look, I think you're exactly right, John, that the reason why we are comfortable in inferring consciousness in the person sitting next to us is simply because of morphological similarity. Now, if the person sitting next to you was, you know, Susan's hypothetical Martian, who was morphologically completely dissimilar, but nevertheless displayed all of the external attributes of intelligent behaviour, you would have precisely the dilemma that you outline. And this, of course, gets why back to it's the qualia, it's the subjective, the personal, the private aspects of consciousness, which are the things that have driven philosophers mad for centuries, which is why I think as neuroscientists or as computational modellers, we can feel comfortable, we can probably make a great deal of progress in future in understanding the computations, probably the nature of the computations, the size of the networks which are recruited in certain sorts of conscious states, which I think goes back to Susan's size of neuronal assembly associated with particular sorts of conscious states. But the irreducible bit, the bit that we have a great deal of difficulty getting to for the reason you outline, is the personal private subjectivity.
Susan.
Okay, thank you for that. Well, I'm not sure whether you're conscious or not, but what I am sure of is if you are, it's not my consciousness. It's not like mine. Yeah. So that's what makes consciousness so subjective and so special. But you were touching more, not so much on the validity or otherwise of thinking that other human beings might be conscious, but on the contribution and the non-exclusivity, therefore, of machines. And I think one can approach the study of computers and robots and consciousness in two ways. Either you can say, right, I'm going to model consciousness, I'm going to model it in a computer. Perhaps that's one of the claims of the Blue Brain Project. Now, let's think about that. What is a model? A model is not a simulacrum. It's, you know, if you want a simulacrum of a brain, just have a baby. Yeah? So it's not a model. So if you want to model something, what you want to do is you want to identify the salient features to the exclusion of the extraneous ones. If I wanted to model flight, I would know that the thing I had to do, the essential part of my model, was to defy gravity, and I wouldn't be too fussed about incorporating beaks and feathers. That's extraneous to the model of flight. Yeah. So therefore, if you're trying to model consciousness, the problem arises, what is the salient feature that we want to put in? What are the extraneous features that we can leave out? And I would submit we don't know that. If we knew that, if we knew what the thing was, the salient feature to model consciousness, frankly, we wouldn't have to model it anyway because we'd have solved the problem, right? So I think that that's not very helpful. Now, the second approach that you suggested is to build a non-biological device of enhancing and increasing complexity, someone like Ray Kurzweil, for example, the advocate of the singularity. People like that think if you have something that's very complex, then consciousness will just emerge as a product of complexity. Now, one can't prove that's not the case because you can't prove something isn't the case. You can only prove positives. And the onus would be on such individuals to prove it was. But then you have the problem of the Turing test. Does everyone know about the Turing test? Yeah, it's where, from Alan Turing, if you're given impartial access to a non-biological system and a brain, and you can ask any question you like, and through this impartial medium, you have to evaluate whether the person's a computer or a person. And as yet, no computer has passed the Turing test, although there is a human being that's failed it, which I think is quite interesting. I think we all know people like that, probably. So this operational definition, as I've suggested, is very hard, because even if you were giving clever or things, as you know, you can just sit there. The whole point of consciousness is not about responses or behaviours, it's about what goes on inside. And that, I think, is very hard to, with absolute, you know, conviction demonstrate in something that, as John Searle, the philosopher, said, might be built of old beer cans. You know, I think the thing that it's built of, brain cells, chemicals, modulators, integration with the whole body, for my money, those things are significant features. I can't prove that they are, but then the onus would be on you to prove with your beer cans that they're conscious too.
Thank you. Well, John, your question made me almost bemoan that we don't have Donald Rumsfeld on the panel, just to compliment our perspectives. Look, we must end there, and I'm sure you'd all like me to thank our panel very much for their contributions, but especially to Suzanne Greenfield for her witty, insightful, and very instructive and erudite presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you.